From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. British lawmakers will try again tomorrow to end the deadlock over the UK's divorce with the European Union. Yesterday, British Prime Minister Theresa May offered to resign if her plan is passed, as members of Parliament failed to reach consensus on a series of their own proposals for how to leave the EU. Let's bring in Rob Watson, political correspondent for the BBC in London. Hi, Rob.
Hi, Jeremy. Everything's getting really clear. Brexit nearly sorted. Be done by the end of today.
No well, problem. It's a good thing that March 29th is not the date anymore, because that's tomorrow. But let's talk about what happened last night. There were hours of debate, a lot of different votes. None of them got enough votes to move forward. What did you take away from what happened last night?
Well, it was a reminder of the sort of profound crisis that Brexit has plunged UK politics into and threatens to take both of its main parties to breaking point, the governing Conservatives and the opposition Labour Party. I suppose it did suggest, however, that let's say there was no interference from party managers, that you could see that there could be a consensus that could be built around a softer version of Brexit. In other words, a kind of Brexit that leaves Britain closer to the European Union economically, in particular that it would stay in the customs union. In other words, that Britain and the rest of the EU would continue to share a trade policy.
Well, the one actually that got the most votes last night was about a second referendum, right?
That's absolutely right. And I guess you could sort of envisage a situation where they coalesce around an agreement on a closer relationship with Europe, which would then would have to be ratified with the people. I mean, I have to say that there's certainly not a majority in Parliament for that yet.
What about the idea of a crash out at this point? That did not do well last night, the idea of no deal for Brexit. Is that becoming less and less likely?
Well, it didn't do well at all, Jeremy, but here's the thing that the MPs have got to understand, that is the default position. I mean, if Britain doesn't do anything, you know, if the MPs don't agree something, then Britain will leave on April the 12th, unless it's either formed an agreement or agreed a delay.
Now, take us inside what's going on with the Conservatives and Prime Minister Theresa May. The big headline yesterday was that she had offered to resign if the lawmakers pass her plan to leave the European Union. So what's going on there?
I think the simplest way of describing this is that she is about to become, if she's not already really, the fourth Conservative Prime Minister to lose her job as a result of Brexit, dating back to Margaret Thatcher. If you want to think about the crisis that Britain is in, it is in part because of the long-standing division within the governing Conservative Party. It's been there since the 1980s and 90s over what exactly Britain's relationship with the European Union should be. I mean, that is why this referendum was held in the first place. David Cameron called it to try and exercise those divisions once and for all. But of course, that hasn't worked. And so she looks like being its latest victim.
So what happens next, Rob?
Oh, my goodness. I thought you were going to ask me a difficult question. Well, briefly, there are five options. I mean, no deal, we already discussed that. Mrs. May's deal, I mean, you wouldn't entirely rule that out. There's some thought that MPs may be asked to vote on at least a part of it on Friday. There's this idea of MPs, as we also discussed, coalescing around a different kind of a plan. There's also the prospect of a long extension. So Britain just goes to the Brussels again and says, you know what, we're not there. Please, can we have some more time? And then the fifth one, which I certainly wouldn't rule out, is just that the government completely collapses next week or soon after, and there just has to be a general election.
I saw last night after these votes that the mood in Brussels was being described as dark. How are they feeling about all this?
Well, I think Brussels went from right at the start of being sort of sad and in a state of shock when Britain voted to leave. I think they went into a phase of hoping that maybe Britain would change its mind. And then I think the last few months it's been, my goodness, what has happened to them over there? We thought that the UK was supposed to be pretty much the most stable and, you know, reasonable country in Europe, and we look anything but. So I guess opinion is split. There are some in Europe who now think, you know what, Britain is looking like a basket case. Let's just hope they go sooner rather than later. I still think there are some who think maybe Britain could change its mind if given a long extension. And then the third group are those who just think Britain has gone bonkers, but hopefully we can arrange its departure in an orderly way so as it doesn't damage the EU economy as well as the UK's.
That's the BBC's political correspondent, Rob Watson. Rob, thanks.
Thank you very much. We continue to entertain, Jeremy.
And just in this afternoon, there will be a vote tomorrow on Theresa May's Brexit deal. The first part, the legally binding withdrawal agreement. Now, remember, her deal has been rejected twice, so we will see what happens tomorrow.
Well, here in the U.S., one of the rallying cries from Republican lawmakers this week has been that Russian interference in the 2016 election happened under President Obama's watch. The Mueller investigation started with the premise that the Russians interfered. Attorney General William Barr's summary concluded that President Trump's campaign did not collude. And now President Trump, who has at times denied there even was Russian interference, is saying it was President Obama's fault. On Monday, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said the Obama administration ignored, excused, and failed to confront Putin's malign activities at home and abroad. And earlier this week, we spoke with Republican Congressman Comer of Kentucky, who laid the blame at President Obama's feet. Now, we said then we'd dig deeper, so let's do that with Greg Miller of The Washington Post and author of The Apprentice, Trump, Russia, and the Subversion of American Democracy. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, how much did President Obama subvert democracy, as Republicans are claiming? Did he completely fail to respond to Russian interference in 2016?
No, he didn't completely fail to respond. He did try to respond. I think that it's fair to say, to criticize or to question the Obama response and whether it was enough.
Mm-hmm.
He ultimately issued sanctions against Russia for interfering in 2016. He tried to get members of Congress to go along with a bipartisan condemnation of Russia during the election. The Obama administration ultimately issued a statement saying that Russia was interfering in the election in October, so weeks before Election Day, but nevertheless never told the public before it was too late all that it knew, including that Russia had a preferred candidate, that Russia was actually trying to help Trump.
Even on the day that, if I understand this correctly, the U.S. security agencies made this major announcement that Russia was interfering in the election, it was the same day that the Access Hollywood Donald Trump tape came out. And so that while the Obama administration thought they were going to have the bombshell, nobody even paid attention.
Yeah, it was terrible timing. I mean, they were hoping that this statement would resonate with the public. This was their plan to tell the people of the United States what Russia was doing. And of course, it gets completely drowned out that day, not only because of the Access Hollywood tape, which of course was the biggest news of that day, but then WikiLeaks came back later at the end of that day with another dump. So that notice, that thin several paragraph statement from the Obama administration did not get near the attention that they hoped it would.
Yeah. The president actually went and personally spoke to Putin at a summit and said, stop interfering with our election. His administration threw out a number of Russians. And he also, if we remember this correctly, didn't he go speak with the newly elected Donald Trump and warned him off about hiring Michael Flynn, who was eventually indicted for lying about his contacts with Russians?
That's right. I mean, this came after the election, when Trump visited the Oval Office and met with Obama. And Obama, one of the things Obama tells him is you need to be careful about hiring Mike Flynn. Flynn, of course, had been fired by the Obama administration for completely different reasons. But by that point, the Russia thread was really significant and there were lots of worries about him.
Yeah. So the administration seemed to do a bit, but even members of the administration, like former Director of National Intelligence James Clapper, have said they regretted they didn't do more. What more could they have done? Because we remember also that there was great internal debate in the Obama White House about how much to do and not appear to be interfering in the election.
Right. I mean, Clapper actually has a great line in his book where he says that he looks back in this time now and is totally frustrated by it because the Obama people were worried about putting a thumb on the scales of the election. And as Clapper puts it, Putin was standing on the other side of those scales, jumping up and down, right? So you can hear the frustration in that line from him. But it's important to remember, so there were a few things that the Obama team felt constrained by. One, they were really worried that what Russia was doing at that point was only the tip of the iceberg. They thought that if they provoked Russia, that Russia might retaliate and go deeper and take down election polling stations on election day, or have a big, big attack on election day that would be far worse than what they had seen. Second, the Obama team really was convinced that Clinton was going to win, and they didn't want to mess that up. They thought she would win, she would be in power, she could deal with the aftermath here. They didn't want to be accused of helping her win. They didn't want to taint what they thought was her inevitable victory. So that was important. But the third thing was that they were undermined by Republicans in Congress, including Mitch McConnell. They went to McConnell asking him to go along with a joint statement condemning what the Kremlin was doing. And McConnell not only refused, he said that he would accuse Obama of meddling in the election if they came out and said something like this.
That's Greg Miller of The Washington Post looking back at what really happened in the run-up to the 2016 election inside the Obama White House. Greg, thank you so much.
Absolutely.
Good news. Julian Fellowes and Elizabeth McGovern have been reunited. He, the author of the hit series Downton Abbey. She, the American actress who starred as Lady Grantham. Now, he has written the screen version of author Laura Moriarty's bestseller, The Chaperone. And Elizabeth McGovern plays the chaperone. This is the story of Louise Brooks, the 1920s it girl with her bobbed dark hair, heavy eyeliner, and reckless ways. But before she was famous, she was 15, and McGovern plays Norma, a sedate woman from Wichita, Kansas, who chaperones the young Louise Brooks, played by Haley Lou Richardson, as she makes her first trip from Kansas City to New York. Norma's husband, less than enthusiastic, but her sons urge her to go.
What would I mind? I think it's great.
Your father was worried.
You don't want to listen to Dad.
This is 1922. Hadn't you heard? Things have changed.
Women vote now and do whatever they want.
Including take a trip to New York.
Well, that trip to New York will change the lives of both Norma and Louise. Again, the film is The Chaperone, and joining us from the NPR studios in New York is writer Julian Fellowes. Hi, Julian.
Hello. Hi.
And star and producer, one of the producers of the film, Elizabeth McGovern. Welcome to you as well.
Hi.
And can we start with you? You always seem to get great clothing. I mean, your character is caught, actually, maybe, in between two eras. She's this kind of timid woman from Wichita, and she's in long skirts and short jackets and the beautiful hats of the day. And young Louise Brooks is in what seemed to be the coming flapper dresses. Talk a little bit about this character and what she meant to you.
Well, I loved the idea that it was a story about a woman who is changing alongside a changing country, making discoveries about herself in late middle age, which is not a story that is told very much at the time. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was a really charming, entertaining conceit that she is impelled into this life's revelation by her interaction with the young girl who's meant to be her charge, who then becomes the poster child icon symbol of this changing time, which was 1920s America. And Louise Brooks became emblematic of this the liberation of women in the form of the flapper, which represented looser clothes and looser morality. Mm. And my character, she has constructed this house of cards on which she's based her life, which is this moral code that she's inherited. And in the course of this journey she takes with Louise Brooks, she discovers herself and learns how to own her own sexual life.
We can't give away any of those plot twists and turns that you mentioned, but here she is sort of in the beginning trying to wrangle this cult, Louise Brooks, who's bounding into a whole other era, the jazz age, and your character is taking Louise to task for dining with two men she just met.
Louise, I am not your enemy. I have not come along to harass you. I'm here to protect you.
What did you think back then when we were having dinner? That they were going to have their way with me in the dining car under the table?
A girl your age does not dine with men she doesn't know. Not without a chaperone.
Why not?
Because it isn't done.
Why not?
Because of the appearance of impropriety.
And Julian Fellowes, I want to bring you in now because there we have Louise Brooks and her chaperone. The movie, of course, drove us to Google. And Louise Brooks did have a chaperone. Louise Brooks lived from 1906 to 85, put out her memoir in 1974, Lulu, in which she writes one paragraph about Alice Mills, the stocky, bespectacled housewife of 36, who, having fallen idiotically in love with the beautiful Ted Shawn, who was one of the owners of the dance company, decided to study dance with him. I tolerated Mrs. Mills' provincialism because she shared my love of the theater. So that's the real chaperone and the little we know about her. You make your chaperone very different.
Well, my chaperone is Laura Moriarty's chaperone, who wrote the novel. The chaperone, Alice Mills, apart from Louise's own rather disparaging reference to her, is unknown to us. And what Laura did is take that structure and then invent a story for the chaperone that tells us about the time these women are living in, so that her story becomes a commentary on the period that America was going through, lived against the true story of Louise Brooks, who is a commentary in a different way. And I found all that cleverly done, these two women at very contrasting periods of their life. And in one way, Louise has everything except complete confidence in herself, and that is what Norma gives her. And Norma thinks she knows everything, but Louise gives her the strength to challenge the way she's been living her life and to retake control. And she encourages Norma to find the strength to be happy.
But the truth, as you said, there's truth here. There really was a Dennis Shawn dance company, Ruth St. Denis, Ted Shawn. Louise Brooks really did dance.
Yeah, and all of that is true. And then she went as a kind of look. She was thrown out of the Dennis Shawn dancers, probably because Ted Shawn was too interested and Ruth St. Denis rather less interested in Louise getting off with her husband. And she went off to Ziegfeld Follies and was a great star. But it had begun to become clear to everyone, including Louise, that her own stellar quality was not so much in her dancing as in who she was. She was this free child. She belonged to the post-war world. She didn't have any hangover of Victorian America and all of that. You know, at that time in the middle 20s, if you walked past a group of office girls or secretaries or shop assistants or whatever, some of them would have Louise Brooks's hairstyle.
Yeah.
And some of them would be dressed and made up like her because she was such an influence. She was saying to them, I know what freedom is. Follow me and you will too.
Mm-hmm. Elizabeth, this is a masterpiece production. Rebecca Eaton, of course, the tremendous executive producer of Masterpiece. And I said to her a little while back, she's based here in Boston, you do so many beautiful pieces from Britain, period pieces. Aren't there more American stories that we can tell, you know? And here is one. Have you felt that way as well, that, you know, we should look back more at our times in history?
Yes, it's true that Britain, especially in television and movies, has seemed to have a corner on period drama that Americans only can sit back and look on in awe. And I don't know why that should be. I suppose it's just been a part of their cultural heritage. You know, they've done them for so long. They do them incredibly well.
I think it's a cultural difference, though, really, that America is a very forward-looking society.
That's interesting.
It's what's coming, what's next, that inspires everyone here.
Yeah.
Of course, they are interested in their history and they say, oh, this is where George Washington lived or something, but it's not in them in the same way. England, really, if anything, its fault is the other direction, that it's too much in its own past.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone is dwelling on the past all the time. Both have reasons to recommend them. But America has led the way in screen acting, in movie making, in all of this stuff, because it has this forward-looking dynamic. So, you know, if the price you pay is that you make less period drama, I don't think it's so high.
Yeah. Although America notoriously absolutely loves those English historical dramas. So I don't know why we don't make them more for ourselves.
Well, hopefully we will. But being the forward-looking American, you both have the new Downton Abbey film coming out in September. Julian, I know that you are now going to reveal to us all of the plot points. Go ahead.
What I will reveal is that it's really good.
I'm so shocked.
Enough said.
But was it hard? Because you're trying to top something that was, for many people, the best.
Well, I don't know about top. I mean, I don't think we've gone into competition with ourselves, but I hope we've taken on the tradition of Downton and the, and you know, my aim, our aim, was very much that people who enjoyed the show for 6 years will enjoy the film, and I think they will. For me, the challenge was that when you're writing a series, every character has a reasonably decent story, probably twice in the series, and the rest of the time they're in other people's stories. Mm. In a movie, everyone who appears, their story within the movie has to be resolved within the movie. Mm. So that was quite testing, but I think we brought it off.
Quick question, Julian Fellowes. The last time we spoke with you, you said you were going to research and do some projects around Edith Wharton, the first female to win the Pulitzer Prize for Literature. And in The Chaperone, there's a scene on the train where Elizabeth McGovern's character is reading, I think maybe Age of Innocence or something.
It is. No, it is Age of Innocence, yes.
So I thought, aha!
Well, I'm a big fan of Edith Wharton, but I'm not so much doing Edith Wharton as Edith Wharton's America. I'm writing a series called The Gilded Age. It's about that time in America that she celebrates in several of her novels, when old New York, the old families, the English, Scottish families that had come over, you know, on the Mayflower and later, came up against the new money that had flowed in after the Civil War. And that's a period that interests me, and that's really the background for my series, The Gilded Age.
We've been speaking with The Chaperone writer, Julian Fellowes, and its star, Elizabeth McGovern. Of course, both of them teammates on Downton Abbey, the new movie coming up. And Julian, we so look forward to your series, The Gilded Age. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
You were charming.
Coming from you, who knows charm, thank you.
Lovely.
Well, we want to hear a little of Louise Brooks. She was a silent film star, but had a few talkies, including 1931's God's Gift to Women. She plays a girlfriend turned ministering angel to the philandering Frank Fay.
I've come to nurse you. Look, I'm all prepared.
That's very nice of you, but you see, August will look after me.
I know, but August could never do the intimate little things for you that I will do.
I'll say he wouldn't.
Oh, darling.
Don't do that, please.
But you must get back to bed. But
it's here now. And a jury in federal court in San Francisco has awarded $80 million to a California man after agreeing with him last week that Roundup, Monsanto's most popular weed killer, contributed to his non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. This second phase of the jury trial was to determine legal responsibility and damages. It was the first time Monsanto has been found liable for the effects of its product at the federal level, and the verdict could potentially set off a cascade of similar cases. Monsanto was bought by the German company Bayer last year. They said they will appeal. Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure, is here. And Robin, tell us more about the plaintiff in this case, Edwin Hardiman. He says he used Roundup to control weeds and poison oak for 26 years, learned he had Hodgkin's lymphoma in 2015, the same year the World Health Organization released its consequential report on Roundup. So tell us more about what it said.
Yeah, the report said that glyphosate, the active ingredient in Roundup, was probably carcinogenic to humans, and that opened the floodgate to lawsuits. Now there's upward of 11,000 of them.
Yeah, but Monsanto's owners say there are hundreds of studies that show Roundup is safe. How are jurors supposed to sort through that?
Yeah, Bayer is saying that Roundup is safe, that over 800 scientific and regulatory reports buttress that conviction. And farmers and gardeners have been relying on glyphosate-based pesticides for north of 40 years. And indeed, 6.1 billion kilos of the stuff have been applied globally just in the past decade. But, you know, juries are also compelled by human stories, however firm or weak the statistical correlation. And it's also incredibly difficult to pin one illness onto one single variable, be it environmental or genetic.
Yeah, well, that's why they use words like contributed to. And this isn't the first settlement against Roundup. The first one was in August last year. We remember it was at the state level. And this was Dwayne Johnson, a school groundskeeper in the Bay Area, awarded $70 million. But now we know his case wasn't a one-off. What does this mean for what CNN estimates are 11,000 other cases?
this certainly boosts their momentum. And the more these are brought to jury trial, the more you're going to see attorneys and consumers emboldened to join the ranks of plaintiffs. And the longer that goes on, the greater the PR and legal costs to bear Monsanto, and perhaps a greater incentive to the corporation to settle. And Wall Street is trying to get its hands around potential global settlement liability today, and there's just too little visibility right now. Another one or two similar verdicts could set the trend.
Well, Monsanto, by the way, pointed out, hey, regulators approved Roundup for sale, so maybe they bear some responsibility. I mean, what does this mean for the EPA?
This has been happening in parallel track, both in Washington and across the pond at the European Food Safety Authority. But, you know, the Trump EPA is much more about deregulation right now. And while you hear a lot about pesticides in late night TV ad solicitations in organic markets, the Roundup controversy isn't quite a household recognized one in the United States. Not yet.
Well, but what about farmers? I mean, they've been using glyphosate to boost crop yields as much as 40%.
Yeah, I mean, it's effective. It's ubiquitous. But this kind of press for Roundup, which is essentially a household known brand, is definitely going to spur corporate innovation in substitutes. That's the good news. The global pesticides market is on track to reach $90 billion in 4 years. And you're seeing advances in nano pesticides or organically or naturally derived alternatives to glyphosate. I mean, even if the trade-off is a fraction of the boost in crop yields. So then you're going to hit up against GMO. It's a hotbed of controversy and innovation.
Well, but just a wake-up call maybe for farmers. Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And everybody, yards keepers.
India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi announced this week that the country shot down one of its own satellites with a ballistic missile. India joins the U.S., Russia, and China in having this capability. And the news comes right before Indian parliamentary elections kick off early next month. We want to take a look at those elections now with Alyssa Ayres, Senior Fellow for India, Pakistan, and South Asia at the Council on Foreign Relations, also Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for South Asia during the Obama administration. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks very much for having me.
And we'll get to the election in a minute. But first of all, just this news this week, how big of a deal is it that India had this successful ballistic missile test and shot down a satellite?
Well, it's a big deal in terms of demonstrating capability. There was, in fact, an announcement several years ago from India's scientists that they had such a capability, and they were working on this as an ambition. So I think we've had the signals for several years that this may be something India would be looking to demonstrate.
And India, of course, is a nuclear-armed country, so it becomes all the more important that they have this capability.
That's clearly the Indian strategic community's thought on this, absolutely. Mm-hmm. India is very focused on trying to protect itself from other countries that have nuclear capabilities close by, of course, China and Pakistan.
Mm-hmm. Now, it comes just ahead, as we said, of these parliamentary elections. What's at stake for the U.S. in these elections?
What's at stake for the United States? First of all, supporting the fact that the world's largest democracy has maintained its free and fair elections over more than 70 years with a two-year emergency in the middle of the 1970s. But otherwise, this has been a place of great, vibrant democracy. The United States has worked hard to maintain strong ties with Indian governments. I would hope that, regardless of who ends up taking power, whether it's a continuation of the current government or a new government coming in, that the trajectory of stronger U.S.-India ties continues.
And the person in charge right now is Narendra Modi. These are parliamentary elections, so it's not like people are actually voting for him specifically. But if his party doesn't do as well as he would like, that's the BJP party. The opposition is the Congress party, and the leader there is part of the Gandhi dynasty, Rahul Gandhi. What do we know about him?
Rahul Gandhi became president of the Congress Party recently after spending more than a decade as a member of parliament. I should note that the Congress Party, as of 2014, is at its lowest ever showing in India's parliament. It is not clear whether the Congress Party can forge a very strong coalition to come back to power again. I think there are a lot of big questions about this election. We'll have to see how it all shakes out.
Well, I want to ask you about some of the issues that have come up since Modi took power. First of all, he came in amid a lot of worries about how he would treat the country's Muslim minority, and those worries have continued throughout his leadership. Tell us more about what's going on there.
I think you have seen over the course of the last 5 years some concerning incidents of anti-Muslim violence, particularly around issues of cow protection. There have been some very violent incidents, including some murders, some people who have been beaten to death over accusations that they have been involved in cattle trade or had eaten beef. Of course, the cow is holy for Indian Hindus. Mm-hmm. So this has been a real issue. Some of India's own government statistics show that there has been a rise in interreligious violence, particularly in two states that have been ruled by the BJP, the state of Uttar Pradesh and the state of Rajasthan. And you've had some of these quite violent incidents taking place there. Now, Prime Minister Modi eventually has spoken out to condemn this kind of violence, but when he speaks out, it's often after many weeks, and then he stands up to say this is not the kind of country we should become. There's been a lot of concern about this. There's been a lot of concern about whether there's sort of a tacit looking in the other direction while some more radical fringe elements take on this violent activity.
Doesn't seem like it's his top priority, is what you're saying.
He certainly does not come out of the box condemning communal violence. Mm-hmm. He has been very focused on economic issues, but when the communal, the religious issues come up, it takes a long time before he'll ever come out and say something publicly.
What has his economic record been like? He's seen as pro-business, but India's unemployment rate recently hit the highest level in years.
Yeah, so this is a really important issue, and it's important for all parties in India. I should say that one of the reasons I think you saw a lot of support for the BJP's platform in 2014 was their emphasis that year on economic growth and good governance. This was, of course, against the backdrop of some enormous corruption scandals that had happened under the previous government, the Congress-led government. And it is true that the Modi government has carried out a number of important economic reforms, some of which were difficult, some of which were also championed by the Congress Party previously that they couldn't manage to pass, including passage of a national goods and services tax that creates a common market across all of India, passage of a bankruptcy law. But you look at all this, and it is also true that over the course of the past 5 years, precisely at a time that India's large, growing youth population, you need to create about 1 million jobs a month to absorb new entrants to the workforce. There just hasn't been the job creation that the country needs. And so that's become a real issue. The national unemployment statistics have not been formally released. People have accused the government of withholding these statistics because it's not good news. There was a leak to an important Indian financial paper, the Business Standard, which reported that the official statistics that haven't been released would place the unemployment rate at about 6.1%. And as you said, that would be a 45-year high. So there's a lot of concern in India about job creation for a large youthful population just right at the time that India needs that job creation to keep moving ahead.
What about access to basic necessities? We know that hunger is still very widespread in India. Access to water, sanitation, electricity, are these issues that come up in the elections?
These are absolutely bread and butter issues for people in India. And here I would note that the Modi government has really done a good job on expanding and delivering these kinds of infrastructure services across the country. This government has carried out a very large toilet building exercise begun under the previous government. There's, of course, questions about whether people are using the new toilets, whether all these toilets are connected properly. But you've got the beginnings of building that
that widespread sanitation mm-hmm. system. So that's been a positive. Same is true for rural electrification. They've made a big, big push on rural electrification.
I just want to finally ask you a question about the election itself. This is very difficult. As you said, this is the biggest democracy on the planet. The voting doesn't happen all at once. It starts on April 11th. It takes place in seven phases. It ends in mid-May. 900 million voters. How does it actually work?
Well, so yeah, I hope all of your listeners will stay tuned for the coming several weeks because exactly right, this voting will unfold. There are 900 million eligible voters, according to India's Election Commission. That's a bump up from the 2014 elections. Now, not all of the eligible voters will vote. In the 2014 election, out of the 814 million, around 550 million ended up voting. But any way you slice it, this is the world's largest voting exercise. One of the reasons the Election Commission divides this into so many different phases is that so they can move all the security and administrative infrastructure from polling station to polling station. Mm-hmm. All the votes will be tallied on one day, May 23rd, at the end of this. So everybody's going to have to, you know, bite their fingernails in suspense until the end of May to find out what happens.
Do they have recounts like we do in Florida?
I cannot remember a large-scale recount in recent years, but they do have the capability to do that. India uses electronic voting machines, EVMs, that are built, designed and built indigenously within India. They do have a paper copy that's printed out so the voter can verify as the voter is using the machine, and that paper copy is then placed and held in a locked box that can be used in case the need of a recount arises.
Hmm. That is Alyssa Ayers of the Council on Foreign Relations. She was also Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for South Asia during the Obama administration and has written a book called Our Time Has Come, How India is Making Its Place in the World. Alyssa, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
In New Jersey, Democratic Governor Phil Murphy says he will sign a bill approved by state lawmakers this week that would allow people to seek medical help in dying. That would make New Jersey the eighth state with a physician-assisted suicide law. And now lawmakers in the state that pioneered the concept, Oregon, are considering whether to expand it there. Chris Lehman of member station KLCC reports.
Meet Bruce Yelley. He's a 65-year-old retired construction worker who lives in Florence, Oregon. And someday, not yet, but someday, he wants to be able to take his own life.
I want the comfort of knowing I don't have to have an ugly ending of life. Just the comfort of knowing I can have medical aid in dying when my life becomes unbearable.
7 years ago, Yelley was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. He still gets around reasonably well, but knowing that Parkinson's can lead to dementia, Yelley is planning ahead while he still can. In fact, Yelley and his wife moved here so that he could take advantage of Oregon's Death with Dignity Act. The act allows mentally competent but terminally ill people to get a prescription for drugs that will end their life. The problem for Yelley? The law requires a diagnosis of less than 6 months to live, but Parkinson's patients like Yelley can live for years, even as their quality of life and mental capacities deteriorate. Yelley's afraid he won't qualify to use the law, even when he no longer has the will to live.
I don't want to have someone have to do my toileting, my personal things for me. I don't want to have 24-hour watching. Don't want that. Don't want to not recognize my others.
Several bills in Oregon's capital this year would loosen the criteria for who can qualify to use the Death with Dignity Act. At least two of them would remove the time limit entirely and only require that the disease will, at some point in the future, be the cause of the patient's death. As the conversations continue at the state capitol, Bruce Yelley is traveling the state trying to drum up support. One of his stops, a retirement home in Lincoln City, Oregon.
You have to have two doctors.
One of the audience members, 93-year-old Frank Signer. He said Yelley's presentation hit home.
I can tell my mind is really going down now as far as memory thinking and doing things and rapidly, and I'm just Figure I'm going into Alzheimer's probably sometime in the future soon. And
Signer says he's worried that he'll live for years without recognizing anyone and needing help for every basic task. He'd support a change to the Death with Dignity law so that he could get help in ending his life in the early stages of a terminal diagnosis.
It's my life. Why can't I have some say-so?
But the efforts to expand the eligibility criteria for the law are running into opposition.
We currently support the Death with Dignity Act as it is.
That's Matt Whitaker with Compassion and Choices. The Portland-based nonprofit grew out of the original efforts that led to Oregon voters approving the Death with Dignity Act in 1994. But Whitaker says Compassion and Choices is not behind the effort to drop the requirement for a six-month diagnosis. He says his group prefers lawmakers focus their efforts on making sure people who are already eligible to use the law can actually do so.
There are people in Oregon currently who meet the criteria of the law as it's written who are not able to access it, either because of some of the administrative requirements or because of lack of education in the state about the law or because of the fact that they receive their health care at a place where physicians are not allowed to participate.
Ironically, another group that opposes the law's expansion is Oregon Right to Life. The advocacy group is best known for its anti-abortion stance, but it also fought to block the Death with Dignity Act from taking effect 2 decades ago. Oregon Right to Life director Lois Anderson says the group still opposes the law, even as it fights to essentially keep it intact.
It's a weird position for us to be in to say, hey, let's let the law work the way it's working and not expand it, because we oppose assisted suicide. But we certainly don't want to be in a position where we're not saying anything about these expansions.
Oregon was the first state in the nation to allow people to receive medication from their doctor for the purpose of ending their own life. Now, 6 other states and the District of Columbia have some form of the law, and it's legal in Montana due to a court ruling. Back in Lincoln City, Oregon, Bruce Yelley isn't sure whether there's enough support at the state capitol this year to pass any of the bills expanding the Death with Dignity law. But for Yelley, time is running out. Several times during our interview, his voice trailed off and he said he forgot the question. Parkinson's moments, he called them. He's worried that his brain will give up long before his body does.
I'm a big boy. I see what they're going to do if I get aggressive. They're going to drug me up and tie me down. I've seen that. That's how they treat people that are aggressive in memory care. I don't want to take that chance that I'm going to be there.
And with that, Yelley packs up his materials. He and his wife are hitting the road again in search of another audience that will listen to him make the case that it should be easier to get a prescription to end your own life in Oregon. For Here and Now, I'm Chris Lehman.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.